Today we are happy to welcome Reverend Art Severance to our pulpit. He is our guest minister. He's minister of the First Unitarian Universalist Church in San Antonio. He's been active in town affairs as well as in affairs of the UU District, Western UU District, Southwest UU District. Art also has three, Art and his wife Kathy have three daughters that are almost grown, he says. Art is also a singer-songwriter. He has an album called Art Severance Searching. And I think you will hear something from him today on his guitar that sits by him.
Good morning. Good morning. It's good to be back here. I was here first in August of 1990. I won't ask you what sermon I preached then. When I was pre-candidating for the San Antonio Church. And then I was called to the San Antonio Church to arrive March 1st, 1991, as my first official day. And part of that day was to come up here to the installation of Fred Wooden. So you and I go back a long way. Unitarians and Universalists in our heritage always had different ways of talking about what it was they believed. The Universalists were pretty consistent on finding confessions of faith going back as far as 1790. And if you look at them, you can see the evolution of faith that we've all gone through. But the Unitarians have always struggled with being careful that they don't have a creed. In fact, of course, part of the creed was that they didn't have a creed. Well, it's always been difficult to try to say what it is we do believe. We're very proud we don't all believe the same thing. And in 1887, the Western Conference, which was more liberal than the Eastern contingent, somebody named William Channing Gannett, who was a Unitarian minister and poet and a hymnodist, we have many of his hymns in our order of service, wrote something that tried to sum that up at the turn of the century. And the title is wonderful because it really, I think, shows where we are. The title is Things Commonly Believed Among Us. Not this is what we believe, but kind of in common. It's in the old language so that it's not inclusive, and I'll read it in the original language. And there are parts of it which we probably would change today, but I think that about three-quarters of it we would be able to put up on our wall and say, yeah, I believe that. This is what he wrote in 1887. We believe that to love the good and to live the good is the supreme thing in religion. We hold reason and conscience to be final authorities in matters of religious belief. We honor the Bible and all inspiring scripture, old or new. We revere Jesus and all holy souls that have taught men truth and righteousness and love as prophets of religion. We trust the unfolding universe as beautiful, beneficent order. To know this order is truth, to obey it is right and liberty and stronger life. We believe that good and evil inevitably carry their own recompense, no good thing being failure and no evil thing success. That heaven and hell are states of being, that no evil can befall the good man in either life or death, that all things work together for the victory of good. We believe that we ought to join hands and work to make the good things better and the worst good, counting nothing good for the self that is not good for all. We believe that this self-forgetting, loyal life awakes in man the sense of union, here and now, with things eternal, the sense of deathlessness. And this sense is to us an earnest of a life to come. We worship one in all, life, that life whence suns and orbits and stars derive their orbits, and the soul of man, its ought, that light which lighteth every man that cometh into the world, giving us the power to become the sons of God, that love with whom our souls commune. This one we name the eternal God, our Father. As I say, with the exception of perhaps the last paragraph, it sounds like language that we could use today. We come now to the time of centering. If you'd like to come forward and light a candle to focus special memories or feelings that are much with you this morning, please come. Otherwise, let us just be centered. I have two readings this morning. The first is from the Harvard Law Professor, Alan Dershowitz. In an article from beliefnet.com, if you haven't discovered beliefnet.com, I heartily recommend it. It's about religion, and you can check any religion. You can even take a test to find out what religion you are. And yes, they include Unitarian Universalism. The article is entitled, Why Be a Good Person? The Super Lawyer Argues That the Truly Moral Person is the Atheist Who Behaves Well. From his book, Letters to a Young Lawyer. For most people, the question, why be good, as distinguished from merely law-abiding, is a simple one. Because God commands it. Because the Bible requires it. Because good people go to heaven and bad people go to hell. The vast majority of people derive their morality from religion. This is not to say that all religious people are moral or of good character. Far from it. But it's easy to understand why a person who believes in a God who rewards and punishes would want to try to conform his or her conduct to God's commandments. A cost-benefit analysis should persuade any believer that the eternal costs of hell outweigh any earthly benefit to be derived by incurring the wrath of an omniscient and omnipotent God. Even the skeptic might be inclined to resolve doubts in favor of obeying religious commands. As Pascal put it more than 300 years ago, you must wager. It is not optional. You are embarked. Let us weigh the gain and the loss in wagering that God is. Let us estimate these two choices. If you gain, you gain all. If you lose nothing. Wager, then, without hesitation, that he, with a capital H, is. Dershowitz goes on to say, I always considered Pascal's wager as a questionable bet to place, since any God worth believing in would prefer an honest agnostic to a calculating hypocrite. To profess belief on a cost-benefit analysis is then to trivialize religion. Even if there are no heaven and hell, there are good reasons for human beings to do better than merely being happy. The truly moral person is the one who does the right thing without any promise of reward or threat of punishment and without engaging in a cost-benefit analysis. Good character consists of recognizing the selfishness that is inherent in each of us and trying to balance it against altruism to which we should all aspire. It is a difficult balance to strike, but no definition of goodness can be completed without it, end quote. And then the second is entitled Hang Six, a biblically correct solution to the Ten Commandment controversy. More than a year after Roy Moore, the Chief Justice of the Alabama Supreme Court, placed a stone monument displaying the Ten Commandments in a Montgomery courthouse, a federal district court judge has deemed Roy's rock unconstitutional. Justice Moore has previously sworn never to remove the monument, but for now he says he'll just appeal the ruling. Below is Greg Easterbrook's suggestion on how to settle the controversy about posting the Ten Commandments in public buildings. Civil libertarians say that the Ten Commandments must not be displayed in public places because this constitutes state endorsement of religion. Proponents counter that reminding citizens of divine law will help rebuild the nation's character. As an aside, I really favor the Ten Commandments. Look how successful they've been in the Middle East. What's intriguing is that in theological terms, Christianity should have six commandments, not 10. Jesus deliberately snipped out four of the commandments, endorsing only six. And the six he favored are moral standards that could readily be posted in any public structure without violating the line between church and state. It is the six commandments, not ten, that ought to be central to the debate. One irony is that if the Ten Commandments commend to the public any religion, that faith is Judaism, not Christianity. The Ten Commandments are found in the Hebrew Bible, what Christians call the Old Testament, which forms the core of Jewish Holy Writ. Christianity honors the Old Testament, but views it as amended by the New, and in the New Testament, Jesus conscientiously rejects the Ten Commandments, replacing them with six. The story comes when a young man asks Jesus what a person must do to obtain entry into heaven. And Jesus replies, "If you wish to enter into life, keep the commandments." Christ often simply said life to mean eternal life, implying that the spirit world is the reality and that the physical world is the veil. Instructed to keep the commandments, the young man then asks, "Which ones?" Which ones? Aren't there a famously invariant ten? And aside here, the author doesn't realize that in Judaism there are 363 commandments, the laws found in the book of Leviticus. Debating which laws mean more than others was a favorite exercise of the rabbinical tradition in which Jesus was educated. The rabbinical tradition is where they argue as much as Unitarians. Still, Talmudic commentators did not take it upon themselves to pick and choose among the commandments that God gave to humanity etched in stone. Jesus, on the other hand, in Christian thinking, holds a divine license to amend the scripture. And here's what Jesus says. You shall not murder. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness. Honor your father and mother. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. A parallel telling of these six commandments can be found in all the Gospels. These are the commandments that Jesus leaves off his inventory. You shall have no other gods before me. You shall not make yourself an idol. You shall not make wrongful use of the name of the Lord your God. Remember the Sabbath day and keep it holy. The Ten Commandments are given in various books of the Old Testament with somewhat various wordings. Because what is significant about the six commandments is what Jesus does not say, the grandeur and the import of the passage routinely missed. Jesus, the child of God, carefully and consciously discards four of the Ten Commandments, basic precepts of 1,000 years of relation between the maker and the made. It turns out that the four commandments that Jesus deletes are the ones concurring formal religious practice. The six commandments that Jesus endorses are the ones concerning morality, love, and good character. Jesus, bear in mind, is considered by Christian theology to be voicing the thoughts of the divine. When proclaiming the Ten Commandments, God placed at the top of the list formal religious obligation, exactly what the Establishment Clause of the Constitution forbids government from taking any stand on. 1,000 years later, Mark is believed to have lived about 9 centuries before Jesus, the Maker, speaking through Jesus, drops the ancient commandments regarding formal religious affiliation and chooses to emphasize moral behavior and good character, exactly what schools and courts could emphasize without legal constraints. The Christian denominations have a long history of averting their eyes from the six commandments passages for a self-interested reason. These verses seem to say that denominations are not particularly important. And what denomination wants to call attention to that? Through the course of the Gospels, Jesus makes a number of statements suggesting that God's interest in religious formality has declined, replaced by a divine emphasis on morality and love. For the purposes of the current Hang Ten political debate, what matters is that the six commandments could readily be posted because they do not advocate any particular faith or advocate religion at all. Rather, the six commandments advocate ethical precepts we all ought to follow and teach, rules that define a life of good character. The teachings are timeless. They are in the precepts of every leading religion, in Buddhism, in Christianity, Hinduism, Islam, Judaism, and every minor one that comes to mind. Let us reprise the six commandments. In these words are everything that we need to ground a revival of public character without the slightest worry of constitutional challenge. So let us hang six. Let us take time to be in silence, to silently pray if we wish, to reflect, to meditate. Let us have a time of silence. I went to a liberal Christian seminary back east, and it meant I learned to translate religious language, and that's helpful to me. A lot of the other seminarians who were Methodists or Presbyterians, Congregationalists, Episcopalians, primarily the mainline denominations, because the more conservative denominations probably wouldn't want to go to seminary with a Unitarian. And so therefore, even the Christian seminary was too liberal for them. So I went to seminary with a lot of people who I got to know who were going to be Methodist ministers and Presbyterian ministers. It was really a good experience. And I had to keep explaining over and over to people what exactly Unitarian Universalist theology was. You can imagine how difficult that is. But imagine trying to explain it to a Protestant seminarian for them to understand. So I decided what I would do is to bring in one of our handy little pocket things that says what Unitarian Universalists believe. I think they're in green now, and you open it up. Well, I put that on the bulletin board, so hopefully people would read that. They wouldn't have to come and ask me. So one of my friends who was a Methodist seminarian came up to me later and said, Art, he says, I have to tell you something. And he said, I hope you don't get embarrassed or offended. He said, I saw that booklet, What Unitarian Universalists Believe, up on the bulletin board, and I thought it must be a joke. He said, I thought sure when I opened it up it was going to be blank. In worship class, we all had to design either a baptism or a communion service, both of which were very helpful for me in my ministry. And then to make it even worse, the professor made me the chairperson of the communion committee to plan the communion service. And so we tried to do it that was somewhat universal, with those people needing the Christian words to hear them. And then I said I would write a communion folk hymn that we could sing, and we used that. So I want to teach you that hymn. It's called Sister Woman, Brother Man. It's in your order of service. I'll sing the first verse once and then ask you to join me. Sister woman, brother man, come along hand in hand. Circle around and love life. The world has seen too much of strife. Start that with me. Sister, woman, brother, man, come along hand in hand. Circle around and love life. The world has seen too much of strife. Take this wine that's poured for you. Break the bread and share it too. Drink the wine, remember love. Eat the bread and feed the dove. Sister, woman, brother, man, we must live the best we can. We are all one, but also two. We are humankind, but me and you. Love is what life is all about. Love is light which goes not out. Spirit of love, on you we call. Let us remember love is all. Sister, woman, brother, man, come along hand in hand. Circle around and love life. Seen too much of strife. I first preached this sermon in December, as you might have guessed, with using Santa in the title, called Being Good from Santa Claus to the Ten Commandments. There is an old story of a Kansas preacher who returned home after a visit up in New England, and one of his parishioners met him at the train, and the preacher asked him how were things at home and what was happening, and the man said, "Well, it's very sad, Pastor." He said, "A cyclone came and wiped out my house." "Well, I'm not surprised," said the Baptist preacher. "I've been warning you about your way of living. Punishment for sin is inevitable. It also destroyed your house, sir." "It did?" The pastor was horrified. "Ah, the ways of the Lord are beyond human understanding." Original sin is original only to Christianity. Jesus didn't teach it. Judaism has no concept of it, nor does Islam, also based on the Bible. And we all share that same Garden of Eden story. One could actually argue that original sin was invented by St. Augustine, or Augustine, in the 4th century. And if you've read his confessions, you know he had a terrible sinful life before, of course, he was saved by the grace of God. And perhaps one of the first things that Unitarians and Universalists way back in our heritage could agree on was that a loving God could not create us originally sinful. Some years back, I wrote a poem about the Garden of Eden and the theology there, and would like to share it with you, called The Garden. "Adam and Eve, the serpent and the tree, did not God make all three? What is right and what is wrong? The day is short, the evening long. When we are scared of the unknown, we long to know how not to be alone. When rules are given and we are told, we barely understand, for we were not old. A piece of candy, a delicate vase, and caught, we put on an innocent face. Remember the delicious feeling of no clothes, running outdoors, bathing under the hose? Innocent childhood full of fun, till old mean time had us on the run. We left the garden sadly, understanding badly. If we were not supposed to eat, why make so attractive the treat? Adam, Eve, the serpent and the tree, and God the Father, he. Too soon we grow up and leave the nest, yet it's our childhood the parents love the best. What kind of parent would it be who shows us pretty fruit from the tree, but tells us not to touch or eat? Soon boring seems any other treat. We are only human, after all. We did not foresee the great fall. Were we not created thus? Surely then it was his fault, not us." Well, Santa Claus around November, I think, starts coming up. I can still remember my kids getting old enough that when I started threatening them with the Santa threat, they would say, "Please don't do that." The idea of something over their head that I could hold was absolutely anathema to them. It really is a way that we parents kind of hold our children's behavior hostage, and we'll give it back to them, you know, after Santa comes. And Santa only gives you something, of course, if what? If that list shows that he checks twice, by the way, whether you've been naughty or nice. It's not too hard, then, to think of Santa Claus as kind of like this godlike figure that gives us eternal life in heaven if we're good, but eternal damnation if we are bad. But what does it mean in this day and age, and for those of us who may not believe in that kind of Santa Claus God anymore, what does it mean to be good? Is there a universal goodness, a morality for all time and people? Well, the short answer is yes, in case you have to go somewhere. But getting there is not so easy. Teachers, therapists, seminarians all study something called Kohlberg's theory of moral development, and perhaps in social work as well, I think. it is a good way of thinking about the evolution of how we become moral, and it's done not from a religious point of view, but from a psychological point of view. They have the different levels, the first being the pre-conventional, or what they call the pre-moral. Moral values for the child to be responsive to rules, but only really in terms of pleasant or unpleasant consequences or action, or in terms of the physical powers of those who impose the rules. That's when you said to your child something that you swore you would never say, and that's because I'm bigger, that's why. That is the pre-moral stage. The first stage is the obedience and punishment orientation, naively egoistic orientation, thinking we don't have to do anything mom and dad says, and hopefully we're cleared of that pretty soon. Level two, which is the conventional or role conformity, where moral values reside in performing the right role, maintaining the conventional order and expectancies of others as a value in its own right. The good boy, good girl orientation to approval, to pleasing and helping others, conformity to stereotypical images of the majority or natural role behavior. Stage four, the authority and social order maintaining orientation, that idea of doing your duty and to show respect for authority and maintaining the given order for its own sake. Level three is probably closer to where most Unitarian Universalists are, and that is the post-conventional stage, self-accepted moral principles, where morality is defined in terms of conformity to shared standards, rights, or duties apart from supporting authority. The standards conform to are internal, not external, and action decisions are based on an inner process of thought and judgment concerning right and wrong. Stage five, the contractual legalistic orientation, and then lastly, the morality of individual principles of conscience. That idea that we really know what is right and wrong within us. One of my colleagues defined sin once as being a jerk. I like that because it's fairly understandable. The other name in morality is probably Immanuel Kant and the idea of the categorical imperative. And for those people who've forgotten Philosophy 101, he wrote, "Constrained only by the principle of universality, the practical reason for any rational being understands the categorical imperative to be, act only according to the maxim, whereby you can at the same time will that it should become universal law." Very similar to what the kids said this morning. Do unto others as you would have them do unto you. And in each of those, the individual agent, the person, regards itself as determining by decision in a certain way that everyone, including itself, will always act according to the general rule in the future. In other words, for everything you do, you think about what would happen if everyone else in the world did the same thing. That's the categorical imperative. Or it could be as simple as what Abraham Lincoln described when he said, "When I do good, I feel good. When I do bad, I feel bad. That's my religion." Lincoln, by the way, was the only U.S. president who has not been a member of any church. Therefore, we think he must be a Unitarian. Unless we personally believe a certain way and accept certain religious authorities like the Bible and the Ten Commandments, we are left then with a moral vacuum. There is an empty space in us trying to find what is right, what is wrong, and perhaps even more importantly, what we're going to teach our children as right or wrong. And what we believe in our hearts is always, almost always, in relationship. Either the relationship to what I call you, me, and the universe, that is, the relation with ourselves, relationship with each other, with our friends, lovers, families, and lastly, our relationship to the universe or to the world. Indeed, if we are good only for a reward or to prevent punishment, we are not good in a universal sense. There is a wonderful story about two 19th century New England preachers riding on their horses to their respective churches, one a Baptist and the other a Universalist. And the Baptist was asking the Universalist about this theory that, you know, everyone's going to be saved, etc. And he finally says, "Well, if there is no hell, what would keep me from knocking you over the head and stealing your horse?" And the Universalist calmly responded, If you were a universalist, that question would never have occurred to you. What we find, however, in the religions of the book, in Christianity, Judaism, and Islam, it's difficult not to find things in clear-cut, black-and-white terms. So for some of us, we turn towards the East, towards the Eastern religions, which are much different, and talk not about sin. Indeed, you will very rarely hear a Buddhist talking about sin, but what we talk about in Buddhism is harmony, to be in harmony with ourselves, to be in harmony with each other, and to be in harmony with nature, with the world. Compare, for instance, the religious authoritative voice of the Ten Commandments with relatively new Buddhist precepts called the 14 Precepts. Basic tenets of ethics and morality in Buddhism developed not by ancient but by relatively recent Buddhist monks and nuns in Vietnam, developed during the Vietnam War, including the famous Thich Hat Nhat as one of the people in these 14 precepts in a book called Interbeing. These, then, are the 14 precepts, which are, they describe it as a unique expression of traditional Buddhist morality coming to terms with contemporary issues. These were developed not by secluded monks attempting to update traditional precepts. Rather, they were forged in the crucible of war and devastation that was the daily experience for many of the Southeastern Asians during those decades. One, do not be idolatrous or bound to any doctrine. Do not be idolatrous about any doctrine. Not don't make idols, but don't be idolatrous to any doctrine, theory, or theology, even Buddhist ones. All systems of thoughts are guiding means. They are not absolute truths. Two, do not think the knowledge that you presently possess is changeless. Avoid being narrow-minded and bound to present views. Learn and practice non-attachment. Truth is found in life and not merely in conceptual knowledge. Be ready to learn throughout your life and to observe reality in yourself and your world at all times. Three, do not force others, including children, by any means whatsoever, to adopt your views, rather by authority, threat, money, propaganda, and even education. However, through compassionate dialogue, help others renounce fanaticism and narrowness. Four, do not avoid contact with suffering or close your eyes before suffering. Do not lose awareness of the existence of suffering in the life of the world. Find ways to be with those who are suffering, by all means, including personal contact, visits, images, and sounds. Five, do not accumulate wealth while millions are hungry. Do not take as the aim in your life fame, profit, wealth, or sensual pleasure. Live simply and share time, energy, and material sources. Six, do not maintain anger or hatred. As soon as anger and hatred arise, practice the meditation on compassion in order to deeply understand the persons who have caused anger and hatred. Learn to look at other beings with the eyes of compassion. Seven, do not lose yourself in dispensation and in your surroundings. Learn to practice breathing in order to regain composure of body and mind, to practice mindfulness, and to develop concentration and understanding. Eight, do not utter words that can create discord and cause the community to break. Make every effort to reconcile and resolve all conflicts, no matter how small. Nine, do not say untruthful things for the sake of personal interest or to impress people. Do not utter words that can cause hatred or division. Do not spread news that you do not know to be certain. Do not criticize or condemn things you are not sure of. Always speak truthfully and constructively. Have the courage to speak out about the situations of injustice, even when doing so may threaten your own safety. 10. Do not use the Buddhist community for personal gain or profit, or transform your community into a political party. A religious community, however, should take a clear stand against oppressive and justice and should strive to change the situation without engaging in partisan politics. 11, do not live with a vocation that is harmful to others, to humans, or to nature. Do not invest in companies that deprive others of their chances to live. Select a vocation which helps you to realize your ideal of compassion. 12, do not kill. Do not let others kill. Find whatever means possible to protect life and to prevent war. 13, possess nothing that should belong to others. Respect the property of others, but prevent others from enriching themselves from human sufferings or from the sufferings of other beings. 14, do not mistreat your body. Learn to handle it with respect. Do not look on your body as only an instrument. Be fully aware of the responsibility of bringing new lives into the world. Sexual expression should not happen without love and commitment. Meditate on the world into which you are bringing new beings. Do you find them a little different than the Ten Commandments? Does it help to know that Buddhism does not really have a God concept? It is certainly not an atheistic religion, but it has no concept of a divine being telling people what to do. Instead, these seem more practical, more contemporary, more down to earth, and they are not commandments, but suggestions. It is because, you see, we must develop our own morality in the end, just as we develop our own theology, our own religion, and not for all time to be chiseled in stone, but allowed to be evolving, even as we evolve emotionally, physically, chronologically, intellectually, spiritually. Our churches and our fellowships should be places for us to learn how to grow a soul, how to learn to fully love, practice compassion, how to be transformed. One of my friends and colleagues, Reverend Dennis Hamilton, minister of the Horizon Church up near Dallas, once said, "Ministry has made me a much better person than I ever planned to be." Many of us could say, hopefully, the same thing about our churches. The Quran says, "Save a life, save all humanity. Take a life, kill all humanity. And dispute ye not with the people of the book, except with means better than mere disputation, unless it be with those of them who inflict wrong and injury. But say, we believe in the revelation which has come down to us, and that has come down to you. Our Allah and your Allah is one. Let there be no compulsions in religion." It says that in the Quran. "Truth stands out clear from error. Whoever rejects evil and believes in Allah has grasped the most trustworthy handhold that never breaks." Surely that's not the same Quran as Osama bin Laden's. The Muslim poet Sa'di wrote, "To worship God is nothing more than to serve people. It does not need rosaries, prayer carpets, or robes. All peoples are members of the same body, created from one essence. If fate brings suffering to one member, the others cannot stay at rest." End quote. Morality must be universal if it is to be truly moral. And further, it must not require a certain belief of a certain deity or six things that you have to believe before breakfast. Religion should be about how to live our lives, how to become better people, how to help one another and the world, how to find meaning in our confusing world. I sometimes quote an early Unitarian who said, "I spell God with two O's and the devil without the D." We are called by the religious spirit of good, of love, of compassion, of justice. We, as you use, do not have a central creedal belief, but we do have suggestions, perhaps better described as ideals, goals to live up to, what we call the purposes and the principles of our denomination, that we came up with, not written in stone by God, But in typical Unitarian Universalist fashion, that is, in countless meetings, in endless discussions, and then finally voting. But because of that, we came up with purposes and principles that we hold up as ideals. Let me share something that I wrote some time ago for a wedding that has become a part of every wedding or sacred union I now do, and in good Unitarian fashion, it's called the 10 Suggestions. Number one, find out who you really are and what you want out of life. Then find out what life wants out of you. Find your own way to be religious. Two, give up the need to be right. Usually you're not. When there is stress in your relationship, find your part of the blame. Admit it. Be the first to apologize. Then change that part of your behavior. Three, cultivate love all around you. Develop and nurture a deep and profound love of life and people. Four, be slow to anger but quick to forgive. Grudges are much too heavy to carry around, and they tend to multiply the longer that we hold on to them. Five, take care of your heart, your mind, and your body. Practice love, intellectual stimulation, and physical health. Six, find a way to make the world a better, happier, more loving, and just place for you having lived in it. Seven, beware the great sin of cynicism. Attempt to see the positive instead. Avoid putting others down. Eight, be kind to animals, and then be as kind to each other as you are to animals. Be kind to Mother Earth. Nine, a very important one, have lots of fun. Don't take life too seriously. Don't work too hard. Find a job that you love that doesn't feel like work. And remember that no one on their deathbed wishes they'd put in more time at the office. 10, learn to truly share. Working for social justice in the world and relational justice in your relationships. And then finally, from the ancient animal world, comes the dog's 10 commandments. 1, never pass up the opportunity to go for a joyride. 2, allow the experience of fresh air and the wind in your face to be pure ecstasy. 3, when loved ones come home, always run to greet them. Take naps and stretch before rising. 5, run, romp, and play daily. 6, when someone is having a bad day, be silent, sit nearby, and nuzzle them gently. 7, thrive on attention and let people touch you. 8, when you're happy, dance around and wag your entire body. 9, no matter how often you're scolded, don't buy into that guilt thing and pout. Run right back and make friends. 10, delight in the simple joys of a long walk. And as someone said, please make me the person that my dog thinks I am. May we lead moral lives, full of compassions for ourselves, for others, and for the world. May we show that in our living. Shalom, salam, peace, now more than ever.